Hi, this is Dara Harris from the High Performance Department of the Toronto Blue Jays here with the walk-off. Very excited to hang out with Adam and Scott.
Baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the walk-off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard podcast for the casual fan.
And another one. My goodness.
So excited to be joined by today's guest, the assistant director of the high performance department for the Toronto Blue Jays, Dara Harris. Welcome to the walk-off. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
You've got a voice. You're sounding good. I know we've tried to get you on a few times, and you were about, a month without a voice?
Yeah. Red tide in Florida, a very un-Canadian problem. But yes, so now finally much better. Thanks for being patient.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for being here. You're in Florida right now?
Yes. So I'm based at our player development complex in Dunedin. So I live in St. Pete, really close by, but I'm in Florida year-round.
So are there people with the high performance department that are with the team right now then? Like, did you go from Florida to Buffalo to Toronto? Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So we have parts of our high performance team that stay with the major league team, all season. And also, honestly, they come down to Florida in the off season. So it really, we flex for what they need. Some of us are based, like me, more on the minor league and development side. And then some of us are based actually with Toronto and with the major league team.
So the high performance department, and we do have listener questions for you here, which we'll get to at the end.
Yeah. But like, what is high performance? Does that mean other people are low performance? We have lots of that. So
you're nailing the question. Basically, what is high performance? What does that department do and mean?
You know, I really think the easiest way to think about it is everything that supports the athlete that isn't directly the teaching the baseball piece. Right. So if you're thinking about an athlete holistically, and we want to optimize everything, right? At this level of performance, people are probably doing 80% of things right across the board. So in any MLB team. So we like to think that we work in that 20%. So we're looking for the special thing about that player, how they work, you know, how do we maximize their nutrition, their medical health, their mental performance, their workouts, their development in that sense. So when I hear high performance, I think everything in support of the athlete, probably the easiest way to think about it.
So for you, when you joined, so you're a physician, you've won teaching awards. When you became a member of the high performance department, what is your role within it right now? And what kind of inspired you to get into this whole thing?
It's so wild. I mean, if, you know, obviously one of our big values is being a learning culture. And I think there's a funny way where I'm sort of the proof of the pudding because I didn't come from baseball, right? And I told them in the interview process that a casual fan was potentially generous. I grew up, I just didn't have anyone teaching me baseball, right? So the way I talk about it with the players and the coaches is I'm missing the little league piece, right? So, you know, everyone here had to teach me 6-4-3 double play.
Right.
Now, if we bring in like a baseball physicist, fine, we're all starting, you know, kind of from the same place. But that was really the most beautiful part of this. When I came in, I came to see a spring training. And I was really coming because I thought I would bring teamwork lessons back to medicine, right? I thought that would be the piece. Totally fell in love with the culture. And it was interesting, you know, I'm walking around, right? And I don't know where to stand. You know, I'm trying not to die with fly balls, all of the things that are, you know, parts of being at this. And what hit me over and over again was I could ask any question. I could see how like they were thinking through what a drill taught. And as much as I love that learning setting I was in, there was something totally different here from even the medical school culture that I was in, and just absolutely loved it. So when they opened up the role that I have, they said, hey, we want to do something different. We want to look at learning in a different way. So at that point, I had, you know, 120 students in every class in four classes. So, you know, I'm trying to get 500 people to learn at different places. They know different things. So what we all were intrigued about is, can we individualize learning and performing under pressure, similar to how I was thinking about with medical students, but just learn a lot of baseball. So that's basically how it worked.
So I'm guessing it's funny. One of the things that kind of stood out to us when we were talking to the mental performance guys, Ben Freakley and Jimmy Van mm-hmm. Ostrin, mm-hmm. was yeah. the collaborative nature of everything within the organization. And it seems like that's kind of something that drew you to it as well, right? Was just yes. how invested everyone is in each other's stuff, right? Like,
right. Which, you know, if you think about it, I had 3 days of being with them. I did know my boss, Angus, well from like a couple of years, but I picked up my family. I retired from medicine and I moved to Florida. Like, I mean, I was right. Thank goodness. Right. Cause I mean, if I'd been wrong, yeah. I really just disrupted my entire life, but it is really compelling, you know, and I mean, everybody has stuff to figure out, but that commitment that we make each other better, I had just never been around that. And now it's, you know, it's been amazing. It's, you know, the fun of it. But that collaboration to me, it's sort of, it's kind of big. It's like, you know, and honestly, it sounds slow, right? Because you're like, ooh, that's a lot of people to get going in one direction.
Right.
So to me, the best examples of it are actually, we just find ways to make each other better. You know, so our defensive skills coach, Dallas, teaching me how to hit fungos. I didn't know what fungos were, right, at first. You know, I was like, yeah. is that fun and go? Like, and you're like, no, yeah. that's the name of the bat. And they're like, but so then we called it fun and go for a while, just because, I mean, at some point, right? So, yeah.
So for high performance, like when did the department take root within the Toronto organization? And I know that mm-hmm. this is like a movement that has happened across Major League Baseball. When did it become more prevalent in baseball in general? Because I know you go back even 20 years and it was right. almost non-existent.
Right. So I think what's interesting about Mark as a leader is his ability to look within baseball and outside of baseball to find competitive advantages. And so one of the things that hit me the first time we talked was he was saying that learning is really the only sustainable competitive advantage, right? Because whatever you do, somebody else is gonna start doing it. And so if you're not pushing yourself and thinking differently, you always fall behind. So when, you know, they were coming in to build, the first hire actually was my boss, Angus, one of his first hires. And my boss had a background, you know, it was multi-sport and different too. So some of the pieces like strength and conditioning or medical were there, right? Mm-hmm. So they were a part of baseball. But this was the idea that we could take those traditional elements and then build in that whole athlete piece, right? So, you know, leveraging the expertise of mental skills or nutrition, and now, you know, sports performance, which is my other really big. So learning and sports performance, those are the big ones for me. And that's the integration of technology too.
So, and I mean, you're kind of touching on it there with technology. Sports mm-hmm. science in general is just changing the way athletes and organizations train and prep for a season.
Right.
And I know we touched on that it didn't even exist a decade or two right. ago. So in your opinion, what are the biggest differences and gains made over the last decade? Where are some of the things that if we go back 10 years in time, yeah. what wouldn't exist?
That's a fun one. You know, technology has been interesting to me. So I'm much more on the people side. So I feel like the technology piece can be a tricky pendulum, right? So we can swing it all the way into like studying every aspect of them. And then you're like, what matters. You know, we've lost it. I mean, we have technology that can give us a 500 point variable list. I mean, right. Yay, but oh my God, what do we do with that at all? So I think my approach has been, you know, what problem are we solving? So that actually on some levels hasn't changed, right? Some of the core problems, you know, durability for a long season, inherent in baseball. So what we've really tried to do is work with the coaches in the front office. What are your questions? What do you feel like could we leverage? And then we're trying to make the technology just show up for that. So when I think about your question, you know, what didn't exist, I think most of it is, you know, new ways of more precisely measuring something that we've been thinking about.
Right.
But we honestly have found, you know, we took a coach entered scale, right? So we're saying to a coach, hey, I want you to look at practice and rate it from 1 to 5 on how intense it is, you know, basic thing like that. And we found that it held up very nicely against very expensive technology that was also measuring the same thing. So the biggest piece, you know, I would say if you look at it, you're going to go, okay, 10 years ago, we weren't measuring things. What I hope in the next 10 years you say is that we measured things for the right problems and the right reasons.
That's baseball to a T, though, isn't it? It's marrying that data and human side together. Because you can just be so data heavy and just, or you can ignore the data and then you're also doing yourself a disservice.
Right. And if you think about it, if we can be good at both, and it's funny, I mean, I absolutely have fallen in love with the sport in the last 3 years. I think the thing I like the most is its impossibility. Like everything about it is impossible, right? And then it's all measured. And then we're still impossible, right? So as we go through that, I think that's
I love the way you just described that, Dara. That is baseball to a T, just impossible. Like, yeah.
And how can you not fall in love with the humans that are doing that, right? Who are picking that? I think that's just been so fun to watch, you know, how do they ride all those differences? And there are parts of baseball that are really like designed against learning, which I also think is a fun problem. Because
I'm worried on that a little bit. Yeah.
So if you are going to do standard behavior training, right? Let's say you're going to train your dog and you want them to do something. The easiest way to do it, right? Positive reinforcement. So why is everybody standing there with a treat trying to get their dog to sit, right? You're just saying yes, yes, yes. And then, you know, in baseball, hitting the baseball is incredible if it's 3 out of 10. Like that's not the kind of reinforcement schedule you would use to do a new skill. But it's like gambling, right? And gambling is really, you know, pretty stable behavior. So the challenge of really setting up clear learning settings, like in a cage or a pen, so that you reinforce only the thing you want to have happen, because then when it goes out in the world, you know, you have no control over how it's reinforced. It's pretty amazing.
Right, right. Yeah. So you tweak something in somebody's swing, but then the reinforcement still only shows up 30% of the time.
Right? They have to hold on to faith. Yeah. You know, they have to believe.
Yeah.
And I think there's an element of coaching that's just borrowing their belief in you, right? Like, I think that's part of what we do is we're like, no, we tweaked the swing. Hang in. Because in 10 games, we're going to know it worked. But like, that means, you know, how many strikeouts do you have to do that you're just believing in the coach, honestly, right?
And as if there's not enough obstacles, the other team is trying to get their pitcher to, you know, like adjust to exactly what you just adjusted to. Yeah, it's wild.
It really becomes, you know, at first it's truthfully, it was super overwhelming. I mean, I sat in my first meeting and I mean, I came from a discipline that has nothing but like mnemonics and abbreviations and weird words, like totally dead. And I thought that first one, oh my God, I'm never going to use velo in a sentence. I haven't used Velo since college, right? It's not a big part of medicine or the kind of medicine I did. And, you know, to gradually have that depth, you know, be taught has been really fun.
That's so interesting to hear, though, that like a professional such as yourself, who's a doctor, is sitting in a meeting being like, who should I be here? Like,
one of the best ones. And again, the humor, I didn't say this, like I didn't, you know, email this to the team or even honestly just said it to one person, but we kept talking about winter ball. And this is very early on. I'm like, I'm guessing that's not a fancy dress up dance ball, like not that. So for a while, it was a lot of Cinderella gifts.
Right. Gowns involved.
Yeah. And I was like, okay. Right. But now I would have trouble, you know, flipping it back, you know.
Right.
So it's been really, you know, a powerful arc to see, you know, play out. But that Blue Jays value for humility was certainly very early, you know, trying to learn everything.
Can I just jump in here? You mentioned having faith in the coaching staff for the players. How involved is the high performance department with the coaching staff? Like, are you also tweaking Pete Walker's sleep schedule to make sure he's, you know, in a good state of mind?
I love that. That's a great question. So it's really been interesting to watch kind of the evolution of our involvement. You know, understandably, in the beginning, we were very small staff, totally player focused, not talking a lot about, you know, kind of anything else. And then over time, it has been really powerful to see, you know, we have I call it an opt-in model. So everything, you know, is offered. Coaches can take advantage of it. You know, players too. Like, there's very little that has to be, you know, enforced. Everything is, you know, here's something you can do. You know, honestly, sometimes you do get to points where you're like, we have to solve the problem. You don't have to solve it this way, but we have to solve it. But so for coaches, you know, we talk to scouts about how to find nutritional food on the road. We do talk about sleep. I think one of the fun, bigger pieces, and again, this has always been a part of really incredible coaching, is the ability to adapt, right? I mean, if you look at Pete Walker's, you know, group of pitchers, I mean, they couldn't be more different. I mean, you know, whether that's physically or life experience or experience in the game, right? So part of what we've been doing is also, you know, thinking about how each player learns. And, you know, that becomes something where, you know, you're trying to figure out the right cue, the right message, the right frequency or depth. So yes, you know, and a lot of it, the coaches actually wanted to look at their own learning styles. So almost every coach did similar tests to what the athletes did. Then we sat down together, right? So as soon as we started talking about athlete learning, pretty much every coach in the org said, well, how do I learn? You know, so that was a really fun piece.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty obvious that one of the more negative sides of the game is injuries, right? Yeah. And I'm sure that that is a portion of your job that you are very involved in. Mm-hmm. What is it like for the high performance department with these guys who need to rehab over long periods of time? I can imagine that there's more obstacles to that than just the physical side.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really been, so one of the things I find interesting is there are people who will tweet things about, oh, you can't figure out injuries, it's too complex, it's, you can't predict them. And my thought every time is, that must be easier to say if you don't look players in the eye every day.
Yeah.
So I agree, it's an incredibly complex problem. We're never going to get it down to this one thing that every player should do or that. But it is also the most worthwhile problem to solve, because that's part of caring for them and showing up for them, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what we're trying to do, you know, is to basically understand every player's individual risk, right? So if you play the game and you're a pitcher, you have a certain kind of risk, sort of famously Tommy John's, right? Yeah. But there are other ones. And then position players, it's kind of famously the hamstring, right? But there's a top 50 list of the 50 most common, you know, injuries you can have in baseball, and they vary by position and a couple of other factors. So what we're hoping to do is, if we understand the athlete, you know, what their current physical exam is like, do they have limited range of motion? What injuries have they already had? And then what risks do they have just by the position they play? Then we want that to basically be line by line a plan for that athlete, right? So now, whatever your individual things are, I can show you, here's how we show up in the recovery room for you. Here's how we build your body in a different way so you're more balanced, whichever of those things we need. Mm-hmm. So I think that piece, and then when you add it on, then you're like, what's the best nutrition for recovery? How do you shift your mental game the first time you hit the wall, where your body can't solve the problem? So it really is that same piece. And then the sports science questions of, how do we design the best hamstring program that's really for how you move, not just, you know, hamstrings in general. So it's a lot of individualization.
Of course it's individualized. Yeah, that makes sense. Like, I know when we sat down with Tim Mayza at the beginning of the season here, and he's like, you know, obviously he was super excited. He had fully recovered from Tommy John, and he was just on the verge of making the team when we were talking to him. And just like, you could genuinely see the man's excitement just to be back in the team, with the team. Yes. That was one thing that I hadn't even thought about, is that when he was bringing up the most difficult part of being injured, what he mentioned was he no longer felt like he was part of the team. He was like, I just wasn't around these guys.
Right.
So the mental side of it is such a big thing. I mean, obviously Ben Freakley and Jimmy Van Ostrand kind of opened our eyes to that with their portion of that. From the high performance side of things.
Right.
How much talking are you doing with these guys? I'm guessing the communication just is open all the time.
Yes. And it's interesting to see. I really appreciate that piece of the isolation. You know, part of what we've done, you know, this year too, is if it's not a long-term rehab, we really try to keep you with your team.
Right.
You know, so that you can stay with the major league team, or you can stay with your group. When it is
that new, that's new to this year or two, isn't it?
You know, I think it depends. You know, it's probably been done, you know, for different cases, but it really is something that, and it's kind of funny on the COVID side of things, because it made it harder for people to go in and out. There is sort of a very small win on that, which it made it like, if this is a smaller time, then let's really try. But I know that we definitely appreciate that piece. So we try to keep, you know, the more short-term stuff with the team if possible. And then sometimes there are resources that we just don't have when we're traveling. So we can do it at the PDC. Now, it used to be that the facilities were so small and so limited that, rehab would take out a different site, you know. But the big new player facility means that we actually, you know, they share the weight room. Right. You know, they're in the cafeteria. So, and that was something that actually really mattered to Mark, specifically, was thinking about rehab players and having them be part of the facility, part of the team. And we've also started, you know, doing some things about picking the jersey back up, right? So being intentional about those transitions back. It's a lot. It's a lot for them to go through, for sure.
That's interesting you brought that up about putting a little bit more effort into keeping them with the team, because I know that was one thing that stood out to me about George Springer's injury the second time around, is I was like, he's still right there in the clubhouse, which is not something you see all the time.
Yes. And I think that's been a big benefit for all of us. And, you know, I think it's fun to see the chemistry that happens, and to, you said it, like the talking all the time, you know, one of the weirdest parts, I don't know if this is true for you guys with COVID, is that when you go to Zoom and you block everything off in hours, you're losing all that social, just what's happening in your life stuff, mm-hmm. right? Everything is like, I'm focused, I'm only doing this. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes we haven't valued enough just those casual interactions, knowing how someone's day went.
Right.
And I think this, hopefully that's something we value way more now.
Agreed. And this, you may have just answered this question with that.
Yeah.
But what has been the biggest obstacle for the high performance department over this pandemic? Because I can imagine there has been many.
Yes. It is hard to single it out. I think from a well-being standpoint, it would be the isolation. There certainly were times where, you know, we had players in home situations where there's no access to a gym, there's no access to anything. And, you know, players are using tape or paint on the side of their wall to get a target to throw to, or, you know, we found ways of sending equipment to places I didn't even know we could get equipment to. So there were logistical things, and like trying to get, you know, a treadmill across a border, and, you know, like, does it have the right plug? And, you know, the number of kind of unusual settings that we solved was a big part of it. But I think from the human perspective, it truly was, you know, combating that isolation. Was the hardest piece.
You don't have to name any names, but was mm-hmm. anybody, like you just mentioned, players taping a little strike zone onto the wall. Is that real? Because the 10-year-old boy in me loves the idea that someone in the Jazz organization was doing that, because that just brings me back to my childhood, and I love it.
Right? Yeah, no. Luis Quiñones, one of our pitchers, was in a location where there were just almost no resources, and figured out how to do that, and he was sending video in. And actually, he had been working on a specific pitch in the off season. So when he came in for our fall development league, which is my favorite camp that we do, and we actually put together a swing and miss video to show him the evolution of that pitch, you know, starting from that wall and then moving it, you know, all the way into the games that he was playing then.
That's, it
was
so cool.
Very cool.
Really neat. Yeah.
Well,
really
funny.
Neat.
Taylor Sacedo, Adam and I talked to him about a week after he got called up, and he was bringing up that he was throwing against a fence, and it was just like, like guys that are literally in the majors right now had to do this sort of thing.
They solved all of those. But you know what I do think is interesting, because you when we're in the draft, and so part of my role also, you know, is in the draft, and we had this really interesting conversation about looking for adversity, right? And whether or not, you know, people have had experiences of it. And, you know, I think actually, honestly, the research shows that you can have so much adversity, it's actually a tipping point, right? And you're not able to develop the coping skills that you need to do, right? The adversity just kind of keeps hitting. And then there's this other zone where I think you start to think of yourself as the problem solver.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And when you shift from chasing some kind of confirmation, I mean, honestly, even your ERA or whatever,
but
when you just start thinking of yourself as the person who solves problems, then that's a really powerful shift. So there was an element of all of this COVID problem solving that I do think helped some of our players just shift that mindset. And so you're not dependent on Rapsodo, you know? You really can throw against a wall and, you know, make progress if you're solving the right problem.
Out of curiosity then, when it comes to the draft, is that something that you're looking for? Is that something you're hunting for? Is guys who have that problem solving ability and kind of...
It's a really nice piece. So, you know, we're thinking about how they learn. We're thinking about, you know, it's interesting because I think grit, obviously, and I love the concept, got a lot of discussions. And then when you try to break it down. What does that look like, right? So if we take the big concept, what is it in practice? And I think part of it is, you know, it's continuing to try, right? So right. you can get incredibly frustrated, you can get overwhelmed, but you dial it back in and then you keep going, right? So if you're looking at a player who's never had to be frustrated because they were always the best thing everywhere, it just gives you a variable if you don't know how they'll handle it. But it doesn't matter who you are. At some point, baseball breaks you. It just does, right?
Like, yeah, right.
At some point, no matter how gifted you are physically, the next thing you have to do requires you to shift. So it is really nice if they have made some kind of change and they're, we call it like, you're okay with the suck, right?
Right.
Because you are going to suck.
Yeah.
And if you can't handle that, then we're going to be in trouble, right? Because that J curve, we talk a lot about that and learning that at first you start to get better because it's everything you're thinking about. But now when you start to really work on something, you'll take other parts of your brain offline. Something else isn't going to be as good. And then you're going to get better. And if you don't know how to handle the fact that you're not going to be your major league self for a minute, then that's the gap that I find people have trouble tolerating. And as long as you have good coaching relationships and other stuff, you can fill the gap.
Yeah.
Small progress, that kind of stuff. But you know, that J curve, it's going to get you every time. It got me, right? I mean, I don't know how to use velo in a sentence. I'm like, what am I going to do? You know, I just kept having to think like, yeah, I am not performing at the level I want to be. Like, I just have to not give up, right?
I love that mental approach.
That's
yeah,
great.
Because
Scott, I'm sure you and I both are familiar with that in comedy, hey?
Like
Scott and I are both stand-up comedians, so often, you know, we gotta step out of our comfort zone, try out a new bit or a new premise,
yes.
and just recognize
and be prepared
that
to fail.
Probably gonna bomb the first few times, and that's not a fun experience. But you gotta do it in order to reach that next level, right? So,
and I think that comedy is an incredible example of learning. I think we have players I think who would benefit a great deal from that, because if you think about it, what you're describing is so interesting. It's people look at perfect performance and they forget the steps, right? And so you have that gap. But what's interesting about when you look at really good people, they throw little things out, learn a lot, do something, right? So then they throw another little bit out. They're not crafting the perfect thing and never, you know, spending months in between trying it. They're doing much more like what you're describing, which is you tell the joke and you go, okay, so I'm gonna change that part, you know, right? You just exactly. modify. Yeah.
I mean, it's probably because both Adam and I are big baseball nerds, but we always sort of relate comedy to baseball because there is such a, and you kind of brought it up at that mentality of you need to fail and then learn and be all right with that. Because in baseball, like even the most successful guys are failing like 70% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And those
right?
are the best guys in baseball, right?
Right. That's the top, you know, percent. And I think what's interesting too on that comedy piece as well is that, you know, you're recognizing that everyone else thinks they know how to do it. You know, so I think that's another thing you guys have in common. And we had our newly drafted players in right after. It's so much fun. It's a great time, you know, getting to know them. And you know, we were talking about this magical transition they make where now everyone on the planet is going to tweet about how they should play.
You know?
Yeah, so like right. yeah. some of them have been dealing with that, right? They're top prospects. But there's a good percentage of them that haven't had everyone know how to play. So, you know, developing your comedic compass, right? Of what you think is funny, what you're trying to be. And the same thing for them, right? What's their baseball compass? How should they play? And then, you know, not everybody who heckles or does it, like, really needs, you know, to tell you. So
that's another aspect that I relate to is like, totally. Heckling, it seems to only exist in comedy and baseball, where
right?
someone can go to a live event and literally scream their face off at you.
It came down, one of my favorite quotes on this is a Morgan Freeman one about like never go to someone for criticism that you wouldn't go to for advice. And I add on, right? I add on, like, to buy a car or a new house or, like, I mean, like a real thing in your life. If they're not the people, like the guy with 7 followers who never played probably doesn't need to tell you how to pitch. Like, it's okay, right? Yeah. He can. But I do think it matters to just some of it you got to sift through. And if you're not going to for advice, then we don't need him.
Adam, did you have something there?
No, no. Nail on the head. That's what that was.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. All right, Dara, I know that I do want to get into the new complex there in Dunedin, because I know we were lucky enough to chat with Adam Kloffenstein, and he actually took the time to video the whole complex and kind of sent us a little thing, and it was just so cool. I'm very curious how much of a say the high performance department had in a lot of this. I'm guessing you were.
It was a great collaboration. Yes. Yeah. It actually started before I got here. But Mark and Angus had been working on it and had viewed a lot of different facilities. And the best part of it to me is that everything that they're doing, it'll be fun now, like after a year of having them in it, to touch base with them again. But everything was thought about from like taking a typical day. So, okay, if you're a major league player and you walk from the parking lot, what's the first thing you see? What do you walk through? How do you organize your day? So, you know, if you're coming into the clubhouse and you're taking a shower, and then the food that you need is right here and the hydration. So you just pick that up and you go into the weight room, right? Everything about those small decisions was thought through. And that's been really amazing to live out. And Mark had us hold back some of the final touches until we lived in it, knowing that it's like, okay, well, we'll want this over here, you know, we'll move through it. So the collaboration spaces, you know, that coaching and HP share. So I think a lot of places, you know, they'd be like, here, over here, you know, separate different parts of the building. And actually, even at the time when we were thinking about where everyone's offices would go, we were making it so that we were together and, you know, solving all of those pieces. So you have traditional spaces, hitting team room, pitching team room, but you also have just big development areas where we're all, you know, together, pivoting because it rained or doing whatever else we need to do.
It must be so cool to just watch this all come together from the start to the finish. And I love too how you brought up that you lived in it. You let the problems appear and then solve them to kind of complete it. Very cool.
Yes. And it, you know, it is interesting. Now we have 3 lab spaces and we're building the 4th, you know, so a dedicated pitching lab, and we're building the hitting lab, and those are biomechanics based. And it's really wonderful to start seeing what we can now do internally that you had used to have to send out.
Right.
And now, you know, what all we can, how we can look at that. It's just been really cool.
Biomechanics have sure become a huge part of the game, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. That's another really big one, right? Yeah. I really do think there are some pretty important distinctions, you know. There are definitely people who are thinking about biomechanics, but really focused on developing velo, right?
Yeah.
And then really the biomechanics field itself is equally concerned about durability, health, repeatability, power. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be interesting to see those fields, you know, evolve over time for sure.
I think a great example with that was, Tiger Woods, obviously, when he was younger, had such a violent swing that was just not sustainable for his entire career, like on his back and his spine. And he had to go through that same, like, embrace the suck of, okay, I got to fix my swing so that I can keep golfing for another 10 years. And I might have to suck and not win any of my
Right.
You know, miss out on the Masters this year because I'm learning how to swing again.
And isn't it interesting too? I think golf has another parallel in terms of like nutrition, fitness, and all of that as well, right? Where, you know, you start to think about, okay, what does make you sustainable and durable? And how do you optimize that? And, you know, truthfully, there's just a ton to learn. I think that piece of nobody's delivery looks the same and nobody's swing does. And so on the back end, how do we really learn what makes something work and not, you know, if it's, if it is, you know, look, oh, it works. Okay. Like you do you, but also then finding the places where, you know, we know if you load a joint a certain way, that puts a ton of stress on it. So I think it's a time that's pretty exciting in the field too. Just, you know, we've had probably 50 or more pitchers through, and there are plenty of labs that, you know, haven't even had that number. So what we're trying to learn, you know, will take years for some of it to really be able to put it into play, which is, you know, wonderful, right? It's an incredible challenge. So
the fact baseball is even finally getting to the point where they're like, we need to figure something out about these arm injuries. Like, yeah. I mean, Tommy John, let's face it, it's been an epidemic over the last 10 years. Like, it really is a bit, and I mean, it's probably because humans aren't really supposed to throw 100 miles an hour, but
it's an incredible, I mean, pitching is a really like complex motion. It was so interesting when I started kind of learning about it, and I'm trying to match it with what I know from medicine, right? So the physical elements of it. And when you just think about what has to fire in sequence for that to occur, and then for, you know, for hitters, it all has to fire consistently and adjust in that nanosecond, right? Of, you know, it really is a pretty unbelievable thing. And I think, you know, like we said in the beginning, you know, there will always be these, you know, beautiful goals for performance. And then I think, you know, part of what we're doing is, yes, let's agree we want it to be that hard. How do we make it that hard and durable? You know, it for me, it's about just not settling for, you know, win-lose situations. Then let's, you know, let's push the envelope on how durable it can possibly be, not, you know, not accept the paradox.
Can I just ask quickly while we were on the question or the subject of elbow injuries and biomechanical adjustments and everything like this? Obviously, sticky stuff was a big thing in the MLB this year. And I was just looking at, just this morning, rereading an old article with Tyler Glass now of the Rays, who blamed the adjustments to the new sticky stuff rules mid-season as a reason why he injured his elbow, right? He had to grip the ball harder or whatever the case was.
Interesting.
Did you have any, and again, you don't have to name names or anything like that, but anyone in the organization who maybe came forward with questions on like, how do I deal with this? You know, because we haven't really seen a big rule. I know it wasn't a change, but an enforcement happen mid-season before. And I've never seen anything like it. And I was just wondering what the feedback was from the players, if they had questions regarding that. Or,
you know, I don't think... One of the things that is interesting is there are so many variables for them on a given day.
Totally.
That I think some maybe have felt that way, but have then also seen other aspects. I think for us, the lack of a regular season before and the uncertainty about their workload has really driven more of our internal discussions. You know, I can't speak for every pitcher or what they're thinking, but for us, you know, we went nothing to altered or sometimes nothing again, you know, very irregular workloads. And, you know, I'm incredibly proud of everything we did, you know, building it up and understanding it. But like we said, some guys were throwing at concrete walls. So I think, you know, more of our focus internally has been about the ramp ups and those pieces. But I certainly understand it's so specialized of a movement that I can understand how you would think of absolutely everything as being potentially part of what changes for you.
It is interesting how just a minute change can really affect a pitcher or a hitter for that matter. I mean, even the hitting motion is such a unique and specialized movement that even just a slight adjustment can change everything.
Right. And it's part of why I have so much respect, you know, for all of our pitching coaches, because I think sometimes just about the brain to brain translation, right? So you have to take something that makes sense in your mind as a pitching coach, and now you have to articulate it in a way that another brain and body can use it. And I mean, coaching is a really, truly a beautiful task. And it's pretty incredible when you think about, you know, all the different things, and you may be seeing something they're not even seeing. So you're raising their awareness. It is a really a pretty impressive thing to try to do.
Do we think 100%. That's one of Pete Walker's best qualities then, is he's just a great communicator? Because he sure got something special with that pitching staff, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's a really neat. And you know, when you care about it, you know, it's that old adage in coaching, right? Like, you have to care first, you know, before they'll do those things. But it is true. And if you know, we were just talking about that gap, right? You know, the gap between what they're doing and where you think they can be. If you think about it, caring about them and communicating are kind of the only things that are going to close that gap, right? And they're going to have their performance make them doubt things. They're going to have everyone on Twitter, you know, all of those pieces. So when you think about, you know, effective coaches, there is something pretty impressive about the ability to transfer belief, to talk someone through, you know, something that's incredibly challenging, communicate across those worlds. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
So it is about freaking time, but baseball has started to make noticeable advancements in inclusion. More and more women are in prominent positions in the game, which I think is the word I really want to emphasize there is prominent positions. Have you noticed this progress, and what are some of the biggest positives you've seen around that in this regard?
Yeah, it is really, I like the distinction you're making too. You know, I think there's some really interesting kind of stages as groups move towards inclusion. And one of my, you know, friends and colleagues, Sebastian Little, has some really great stuff to say about this, about, you know, inclusion is the behavior and then diversity is the result, right? Right. So when we do inclusive things, then people stay. You know, I found this in medicine too. There's almost always this evolution past, you know, kind of the work wife. Right? Right. So there are women who have roles, but they're roles that facilitate men's jobs and performance, right? So if you're not developing her to lead a team, then that honestly kind of doesn't count. I mean, it's good. It's better than no representation. Mm-hmm. But what I do think is unique, you know, within the Blue Jays and what we're trying to do is, like, then that means titles change. That means they go up. That means they lead other people. Mm-hmm. I was just telling a friend of mine, I'd like to coin a new phrase. And so I'm going to do it here, which is, I think it's the Beyonce test. It's my new thing about this. So if Beyonce could come into your work in her full power, like music video power, and the idea would be, oh my God, we have so much to learn from her, right? You could talk about branding, you could talk about self-confidence, you could talk about anything you want, but your immediate thought is how she'll make you better versus, oh, she's going to make people uncomfortable in baseball. Like, oh, we get her to wear, you know, something else, right? I do think that's sort of a bar, right? Mm-hmm. Is that whoever comes in, it's not the pressure to do it the old way. I mean, obviously I should learn everything, right? But that it's gonna look different because I'm a woman, like it is gonna look different, you know? Yeah. And certainly there are women who know way more about baseball, not making that as a generalization by any means. But humility will look different. Assertiveness will look different. So when I think we do something really special at the Blue Jays is when, you know, we really are excited about the differences and not, you know, sort of, well, let's blend in first and then do it. And the PDC has a women's locker room, which is almost unheard of.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I think is a funny thing too, that you guys, you know, most people have never thought of it, you can actually proactively ask, is where do women go to the bathroom? Sounds weird. But in a lot of the, you know, stadiums, the women who work on high performance staffs or baseball staffs have to go to the fan areas. So they have to leave the team areas, go outside of security, go to the fan areas, right? And then they'll be stopped on the way back at, you know, at a stadium that's not theirs. And they, you know, they're either thought they're the players' wives or, you know, whether or not they're supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, God forbid you forget your ID, because you literally have to call the managers or call other people to sort of vouch for you getting back in. Jeez. And I think a lot of people just don't know that that's a daily reality for the women who are traveling. Hmm. Yeah, to all those things. So it's funny, but real estate in buildings is meaningful, right? So the fact that we built a women's locker room and it's glorious is saying, forever and always, we want women to be here. We want them to be, you know, valued and to feel valued. It's a pretty wild thing.
What a wonderful, subtle message that is. Yep.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's not performative, because it's not something that was like a press release and like, hey, look, we're progressive. This is just like something they did because it was the right thing to do, and they aren't doing it for PR.
I love that, Dara. That's
That's great.
The only thing Mark said to me was we needed to outgrow it. And I said, okay.
Yeah.
I love the challenge.
Right? Perfect. I'm like, I got it. I'm on it.
Great.
So it really, you know, it has been. And truly, you know, I am so lucky. This is absolutely, as, you know, a woman, the best place I've ever worked, certainly compared to medicine and a lot of other, you know, places I've been. You know, there's just a lot of fun. There's the inclusion is natural. It's, you know, definitely feel valued. So I feel really, really lucky. And we've made hard decisions along the way to make that possible. And, you know, I appreciate that for sure.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that. That's actually just a very exciting thing to hear about the organization and team that I'm a fan of. So that's great. Dara, thank you so much for your time and just sitting down and sharing your knowledge with us. We really appreciate it. Do you have a few more minutes? We've got a couple listener questions here.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
So fun.
So I'm moving this first question up here because it just fits in so well with what we were just talking about. So the first question is from Jenna in Edmonton, and she says, hey, Dara, super cool you're on the show. I just finished high school and was looking to get into sports science or medicine. Curious about what advice you would give someone who is looking to land a similar role as yours in baseball.
I think twofold. One, get a degree that you love, so that you're bringing a certain kind of expertise. So whatever you find the most interesting problems, it's my favorite way to do this. And it's funny because it actually builds from my, you know, previous job where I was advising residents, right? So, or medical students, what kind of residency do you want? Right. But on some level, when you pick a career, you're picking what problem you want to solve every day. And, you know, there are some that can be very glamorous and can look great, but your day-to-day heart won't be in it. Mm-hmm. So I find that natural curiosity that you have, the things you can't put down, is a much better way. So the good news is there are tons of roads into this, you know, sports science degrees, S&C degrees, medical degrees. You really can pick that first degree based largely on what you're passionate about. And then I would say, like, early and consistent involvement with baseball in kind of any of the open doors. You know, when we see applicants who've tried different things, you know, you can support local teams to, you know, going out and doing something that's an R&D internship. I'm sure each place that you're looking will have different things, but we certainly like, you know, if you're bringing strong individual expertise and passion for what you bring, and then a diversity of experiences so that you can try several different routes in, would be my advice.
Amazing. Thank you for that. Your next question is from Aiden in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So that's the East Coast Maritimes here in Canada. He says, hello, Dara. I've always wondered, and maybe there isn't an answer to this, but when you see reoccurring injuries with a player like Springer's quad, how much of that is genetics, or is that more wear and tear, or is it just bad luck?
Oh, gosh, I wish we could answer that, because obviously, right? No, there, you know what, I think it really does speak to kind of the thing we were talking about, which is we just need to be methodical about understanding him. So it will always be multifactorial. And so what we really try to do is, you know, understand those risks, and then what are we doing for each one? And then, you know, before, when you say it's bad luck, I think the only risk of that is that if you don't go deep on what you can change, then potentially you are continuing something, right? So I think our approach with him is really much more about, let's figure out every contributor we can and manage all of them. And then, yes, at some point there are things that just happen.
Right.
But I think our, you know, our duty to the athlete is to show up and control everything we can, and learn from everything that, you know, that happens to them.
So luck is an aspect of it, but to just dismiss it as that is...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Okay. Your last question here is from Jackson in Sarnia, Ontario. So that's just on the border in Southern Ontario.
I appreciate the geographic references. It does help. Yeah. And I also love all the A's and O's. So if you just say Nova Scotia over and over, I'll be really happy. I don't know what that is. It's my favorite little Canadian piece. There are certain syllables that are just way better when you guys say them.
So. Scotia. Yeah.
Yeah, it's better.
So Jackson in Sarnia says, in your opinion, what is the biggest struggle athletes deal with when it comes to rehabbing an injury? Obviously, we've touched on this already, but yeah, the biggest struggle athletes deal with when it comes to rehabbing an injury.
I think it is connecting the day-to-day with the big result, because what it takes, you know, one of the things we've been really clear about is, right, like, you have injured tissue, you're not an injured athlete, right? The athlete is way bigger than that. So there's a small part of you that's injured that we have to address. But the kind of, if it's a significant injury, like the tiny little daily steps and 10 of those and 20 of the other, right? How to build that into the faith and seeing that it'll get better, I just think is incredibly hard, right? So even the other day I was working with one of the pitchers, and, you know, they were doing a wrist exercise, you know, and it's like, well, what do you think that is? And they're like, and it's ball release, right? But you have to connect that tiny little wrist motion that you have to do 20 of every day to ball release, you know, or is it that you're moving this way in order to create it? So I think the hardest part is, in order to show up the way you have to for rehab, it's breaking those tiny little things and then seeing how that repetition will get you back, you know, to where you want to go.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Dara, for all your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. This has been really fun. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Oh! Osborne with a drive. Cheese and crackers. Shows to pitch to him. Wrong move.
Thanks for listening.